Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, this is Dan Kilbride. I am chair of the history department at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and I am the host of New Books in American Studies. That means that every once a week or so, an author finds me or I find an author, either way works for me, and we sit down and discuss their book with them. Today we are joined by Caleb McDaniel. He is assistant professor of history at Rice University in Houston, Texas. And we're talking about his book, The Problem of Democracy in the Age of Slavery, Garrisonian Abolitionists and Transatlantic Reform, published in 2013 by Louisiana State University Press. Abolitionists have gotten, they get their share of ink in American historical literature. They wrote a lot. Apparently, they never threw anything out. And they are, you know, just to be crude, I guess, one of the good guys of history. And so they get a lot of attention, and especially the Garrisonians, arguably the most successful reform effort in American history, because in 1865, they got pretty much everything they wanted with the outright abolition of slavery, which is somewhat unexpected given that they were so unpopular in their own day, especially the Garrisonians with their the intersection of radical anti-slavery, feminism, and pacifism. That was sort of a witch's brew of the three most unpopular things in pre-Civil War America. So, Caleb McDaniel, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thanks for having me.
So, why don't you tell us about your intellectual trajectory and how you came to write this book?
Sure. Well, I have always been interested in history, obviously. I, as an undergraduate, was one of those history majors who entered school wanting to be a history major and graduated a history major. But my interest in the abolitionists actually has maybe a less sophisticated origin in that the first semester of my college career, I went to see Steven Spielberg's movie Amistad, which came out I think in around Thanksgiving of 1997. And looking back on it now with an historian's eye, it's a problematic movie in some ways, but
it is.
But at the time it was really an eye-opening movie for me and a gripping one. I was coming out of high school. I had been very active as a member of the speech and debate team, and I was really struck, especially in the movie, by Anthony Hopkins' depiction of John Quincy Adams and the power of ideas and oratory to actually affect historical change. So I saw the movie twice, I think, and as I remember, I was looking for a book about John Quincy Adams at that time to sort of find out more about him, and went to Barnes & Noble looking for a biography. Was unsuccessful in finding a biography, but I did run across a book by William Lee Miller, who I think is a scholar of communications, if I'm remembering correctly. And he wrote a book called Arguing Against Slavery, which was all about John Quincy Adams and the abolitionists' struggle against the congressional gag rule. This was a procedural rule that was passed in both houses of Congress that basically forbade anti-slavery petitions from ever being read on the floor of Congress or slavery even really being discussed. And so Adams, after his, presidential career had been elected to Congress and spent a lot of time standing up and starting to read anti-slavery petitions before being shouted down. So this gag rule was something I had never really heard about before that book, really. And was really fascinated by, but I didn't really follow up on that interest in the abolitionists in my undergraduate career very much. Other than a class on African American history, most of my history classes were in European history. And I also had a sort of budding interest in philosophy. I had a short-lived career as a philosopher and did a master's degree in philosophy after I graduated with my history degree, which I think also maybe shaped to some extent the sort of questions that I'm interested in as an historian of ideas and thinkers. But I didn't really come back to the abolitionists until my first year of graduate school in the doctoral program at Johns Hopkins. And one of the things that students at Hopkins have to do in their first year is write a seminar paper, which is sort of a rite of passage that requires students to write an original research article that will be presented at the end of the first year to the entire faculty in American history. So as I started on that daunting task, I was still interested in the abolitionists. And so I started looking at The Liberator, which was a famous Boston newspaper published by William Lloyd Garrison. And I was struck in reading through The Liberator by celebrations that abolitionists held on the 4th of July every year. And I initially was interested in exploring the tension between these, as you say, very unpopular radical reformers who were very critical of American democracy and of the founding generation. And at the same time, they would hold these 4th of July celebrations in which, you know, they did much the same thing that other Americans did on or that other Americans of their sort did on the 4th of July, which mainly involved criticizing the way that the lower sort were celebrating the holiday. So I worked on that topic the first year, but in the process of doing research for that in The Liberator, grew interested in how often abolitionists also talked about events elsewhere in the world outside of the United States. So they, for example, not only celebrated the 4th of July, but also celebrated the 1st of August every year as kind of an alternative July 4th holiday. And that was the anniversary of slave emancipation in the British West Indies. And in addition to talking about British abolitionists and emancipation in other national contexts, they also wrote a lot about things that that I had never really studied or known about before, like the Irish repeal movement led by Daniel O'Connell for home rule in Ireland, the Chartist movement in England for the right to vote for working class Britons, the revolutions of 1848 and various liberal movements abroad. And I started noticing what other historians before me had noticed, but was new to me, all of the interpersonal connections that abolitionists had with reformers of various kinds in Europe. And so that really became the genesis for my dissertation, which turned into the book.
I don't want to get too far afield here, but you brought up the Amistad, and I had much the same reaction that you did. And I don't know if you'll agree with this, but one of the things that bothered me about that film was the portrayal of the abolitionists, apart from John Quincy Adams, who maybe wasn't a real abolitionist. They seem so stiff and humorless.
Yes.
In that film, they just don't seem like real people. It's hard right. to imagine, you know, them actually, you know, having a joke or
right.
enjoying life. They're just so cardboard in that film.
Well,
it's surprising.
It's strange in a way that I think there was an essay actually in there's an anthology called Prophets of Protest. It was edited by John Stauffer and Tim McCarthy a few years ago. I can't remember the name of the author who wrote a final chapter on the portrayal of abolitionists in film that made this point as well, and also just pointed out that we really don't have very many good representations of the anti-slavery movement in film.
Yeah, I think that's right. And hopefully 12 Years a Slave, of course, which is coming up pretty soon, we'll change that. The trailer looks terrific.
Yes.
Why do you think this is something else I mentioned in my introduction? Why do you think that there is so much literature on the abolitionist movement?
Well, I think you made a good point that, you know, they were very prolific, and especially one of the things I talk about in the book was the conviction of Garrisonians that they could shape public opinion by printing lots of things and giving lots of speeches and writing lots of letters and having lots of meetings. And they meticulously documented all these things and were very scrupulous about saving that material. So they are people who it's very easy to know a lot about them. I think that, you know, one of the attractions to them maybe today is that, as you pointed out, they tell us a sort of victory story, a moral victory, that can be pleasing to sort of look back and see abolitionists who are on the right side of history. On the other hand, though, you know, some of these abolitionists, if you read them, they don't really allow you to kind of look up from their story with a real easy, settled feeling about American democracy or about the problem of slavery. You know, they were relentlessly critical, while at the same time, you know, they did mark the victories that they had won.
Right. There's an interesting quote in your introduction that I'd like you to elaborate on, because I think it really epitomizes this tension that you just alluded to between democracy and anti-slavery. Mm-hmm. You write that the map of places where a Democrat could breathe freely was almost a photographic negative of those where abolitionists felt at ease. Could you explain that?
Sure. Well, one of the things that the book is really about is the fact that, on the one hand, you know, abolitionists were very unpopular in the United States. At the same time, if you look at other parts of the world, you know, abolitionists were very popular, for example, in Britain at the same time that they were very unpopular in the United States. And after emancipation in the British West Indies, Britain sort of prided itself on being an anti-slavery nation that had led this vanguard of civilization to you know, rid the world of slavery. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you were to go abroad in the antebellum period, you know, to be an abolitionist was kind of a hallmark of something that you were proud of. And most of the you know, European liberal heroes of the day are people like Lafayette or Daniel O'Connell or you know, to some extent, even in South America, liberators like Simón Bolívar had mm-hmm. these anti-slavery sentiments attached to them. What was more unpopular outside the United States was to advocate democracy. That is to suggest that instead of being governed by some kind of mixed government of aristocrats and monarchs or oligarchies, that people should have a vote. People should be able to have representatives in the government and legislative assemblies. So the book sort of tracks the fact that in a way the United States was one of the most democratic places in the early 19th century world, despite all of the limitations that it had as well. You know, obviously women could not vote, and slavery, the abolitionists pointed out, was the huge exception to the American democratic creed. But by 1855, most states had passed laws that essentially made universal white manhood suffrage a reality across the country, so that, you know, the property qualifications that limited voting and the size of electorates in other countries had been mostly wiped out in the United States. So this presented a dilemma for abolitionists in that, on the one hand, I argue that they were Democrats and believed strongly in democracy and identified the problems with aristocracy. But at the same time, in the United States, they had to wrestle with the fact that, you know, one of the most democratic governments in the world had not only failed to stop, but had arguably enabled and afforded opportunities to the spread of slavery. I don't know if that helps clarify that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. One of the knocks against William Lloyd Garrison and the Garrisonians in general, both in historiography today and certainly at the time, was that because of their orientation toward the political process, as non-resistors, they, you know, refused to vote, etc., that they were accused of basically disengaging from the world and engaging in protest in a sort of abstract way. You contradict that view. You really see them as agitators, as people who are deeply engaged. How do you reconcile that with their leeriness towards getting involved in the mess of political give and take.
Well, I think that, you know, as you point out, and as most writers on the Garrisonians have stressed, a lot of members of the American Anti-Slavery Society, people like William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips, refused to vote or support third-party political abolitionist movements like the Liberty Party or the Free Soil Party. And they were very critical of the compromises that were required to engage in electoral politics. But I do think that historians have maybe overemphasized the degree to which Garrisonians were apolitical or anti-political, because they were very interested in politics and followed what was happening in Congress or in the polls very closely. And I also argue they believed that by giving up political power and the right to vote or the decision to vote, they didn't believe that they were washing their hands of political influence. They did hope to influence what happened in the political sphere. So one of the things that sort of convinced me that they weren't wholly apolitical was, first of all, noticing divisions within their own movement the fact that many of the sort of most radical non-resistance actually criticized Garrison for being too involved in politics. Maybe I should back up in here and say that non-resistance was a sort of a radical Christian version of pacifism in the antebellum period that was informed partly by the ideas of John Humphrey Noyes, as the utopian minister who basically said that Christians needed to behave as if God was already ruling the world, and that meant turning their back on any human institutions that were at odds with God's rule. And so a lot of non-resistance opposed war, but they also opposed voting, because most governments and most states were predicated on at least the threat, if not the use, of military force. But at the same time that Garrisonians were influenced by Noyes and non-resistance, Noyes actually washed his hands of the Garrisonians because he believed they were still too embroiled in political discussions and you know, were still too concerned with the outcome of elections. So that was one thing that I think sort of tempered my view of the Garrisonians as solely non-resistance. And the other problem that really animated a lot of the book was the fact that by the time the Civil War rolls around, suddenly the Garrisonians are basically stumping for the Republican Party and, you know, endorsing Lincoln and the Union cause. Most previous interpreters have sort of seen that as an about-face, a sort of contradictory collapse in the face of events, that the Garrisonians suddenly, after holding their noses for so long from politics, sort of dove in. And I feel like if we understand the Garrisonians as interested in politics and in reforming politics from the very beginning, then that sort of final chapter of their movement makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. One of the tensions that American abolitionists had to negotiate is the very complex views of Americans in this era towards England. On the one hand, Anglophobia was alive and well, you know, particularly in the Democratic Party, but throughout American society. But there was also a sense of Anglophilia and identification with England, at least among certain, you know, the Anglo descendants of Americans. Mm-hmm. And as you say, abolitionists were not immune from negotiating that tension. How did they – what were some of the problems that they had to deal with when they traveled to England and corresponded with English friends and fellow abolitionists?
Right. Well, they were, many of them believed very strongly that that American history was rooted in English history, that many of the best things about the United States had been inherited from the British past. And they also knew that even the most Anglophobic Americans were still very sensitive to what Englishmen thought about American democracy. I talk in the book about all of the travel logs that were published by British travelers, some of whom came to the United States to see democracy because they wanted to see democracy succeed, and others who were very interested in showing that democracy was not succeeding, and published these critical accounts of what they had seen. So strategically, abolitionists believed that if they could capitalize on the strength of the abolitionist movement in Britain, and they could elicit criticisms of American slavery from the British press or from British abolitionists who would come and tour the United States, that might provoke conviction and or shame within American audiences, and move them to do something about slavery. So in the early part of the book, I explain the origins of transatlantic Anglo-American abolitionist networks as rooted in that Anglophilia, or at least that recognition that there were these twin forces of Anglophobia and Anglophilia in antebellum America. But at the same time, abolitionists were sort of taken aback by the backlash against those attempts. So for example, in 1834 and 1835, George Thompson, who was a prominent British anti-slavery lecturer, came and toured many of the northern United States, and he was chased by mobs and you know, people throwing eggs and brickbats at him, disrupting meetings. And I think the abolitionists were actually sort of, this was a crucial turning point for Garrisonians, because it showed how deeply rooted a sort of resistance to anti-slavery was, even in the northern states, and also revealed to them the depth of Anglophobia and resistance to criticism from abroad.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if I get your opinion on something regarding that question. You know, abolitionists were bitterly criticized for their links to England. It was sort of the inverse of what you know, Tony Blair kind of suffered in the previous decade regarding his relationship to President Bush, that he was sort of a poodle of President Bush. American abolitionists were charged with being, you know, the toadies or the puppets of English abolitionists. Do you think that it hurt the abolitionist movement in the United States to be so closely identified with the English movement, or was it just a footnote?
No, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think that was a problem not just for American abolitionists, but really for national anti-slavery movements anywhere outside of Britain after after the abolition of the slave trade and then the British West Indian emancipation. You know, the British Empire was really aggressively pursuing the prosecution of people who were violating the ban on the slave trade and kind of strong arming some other countries into signing treaties to suppress the slave trade. And so in a lot of contexts in South America and in other European countries, I think French abolitionists suffered the same kind of sort of taint by association with British abolitionists. So I do think that it posed a problem that various national anti-slavery movements had to overcome. On the other hand, as I talk about in the book, Britain provided a sort of venue or an audience for American abolitionists who often toured England and gave speeches. And it was sort of a safe haven in a way for anti-slavery activists from various countries where they could publicize their views and have a receptive audience and then return back to the United States or wherever they came from and point to the way that their country was perceived because of slavery in Britain. I do think that, you know, the point you're raising about the way that nationalism can sometimes make Americans not very receptive to critics or to radical reformers is a really good one. I mean, you brought up the Bush-Blair connection, and it reminded me that in a lot of ways, when I started work on this project, I was writing, I was writing sort of in the aftermath of September 11th. You know, I think a few weeks into my grad school career, September 11th happened. And so I was writing about the abolitionists as the lead up to the Iraq war was happening. And there was a lot of criticism of going to war in Iraq. And very often what greeted critics of the war was, you know, the idea that, well, if you support America, then, you know, you'll be willing to support this war, and you won't listen to critics from other countries who might suggest that we should make this an international effort. You know, mm-hmm. if there's the famous bumper stickers about, you know, well, if you don't like America, then, you know, leave, love it or leave it. That's sort of
thing. Right. And who can forget Freedom Fries?
Freedom Fries, right? Exactly. Freedom Fries, yep. Exactly. And I remember too, sort of crystallizing for me in one of the 2004 presidential debates. At the time, there was a lot of controversy over something that John Kerry had said in one of the debates in response to a question about whether he would go to war if, you know, if American interests were threatened. And he said something about how, you know, any proposal for war would have to pass a global test, you know, by which he meant sort of a threshold of showing the world that we had good reason to go to war. I mean, this is still very much at the center of political debates, you know, today about yep. Syria, for example. And the response from then President Bush and many Republicans was that this was ludicrous to say that, you know, the United States would have to pass any kind of global test. So, you know, in retrospect, I can see how the fact that all of that was going on at the time I was writing about the abolitionists probably shaped some of the questions that that I was drawn to in the work, especially the cosmopolitanism of the abolitionists, who mm-hmm. frequently cited as their motto, our country is the world, our countrymen are all mankind. And because of that, greeted with the same sort of scorn by antebellum Americans, you know, we're told that, you know, the antebellum version of love it or leave it, you know, and so the association with British abolitionists and the idea that these were sort of rootless cosmopolitan figures who, rather than being loyal to their country, were sort of parading its dirty laundry before the world was something that was both very rooted in the patterns of Anglophilia and Anglophobia of the antebellum period, but also were maybe disturbingly familiar to me as I was reading them in the first decade of the century.
Hmm. One tension that you explore in your book is the tension that abolitionists felt about the power of public opinion. And the figure you focus on regarding this subject is Wendell Phillips, mm-hmm. probably the greatest orator of the abolitionist movement. And you show that abolitionists were both enraptured by and concerned about the power of public opinion. And especially Wendell Phillips was really influenced by the very well-known writings on this subject of Alexis de Tocqueville. Mm-hmm. How were abolitionists simultaneously worried by and enraptured by the potential of public opinion?
Right. Well, I mentioned earlier that in the early 19th century, most observers saw the United States as the most democratic country then existing. And whether people in Europe were critical of American democracy or sympathetic to it, both sides really agreed that the United States was a society ruled by public opinion, that not just in terms of the government, but even society, cultural mores were all shaped by the majority, that public opinion had a power there that it didn't have elsewhere. And of course, this was a major part of Tocqueville's writings about American democracy, mm-hmm. That public opinion was very powerful. The abolitionists, like most of their contemporaries, also believed that public opinion was especially powerful in the United States. In fact, I argue that that was the premise behind their reliance on moral suasion and newspapers and speeches and propaganda. That's why they believed it could change politics ultimately. Even if they didn't vote, if they could change public opinion, then public opinion would eventually change politics. So they shared this belief that was very common at the time, that public opinion was sort of all-powerful in the United States. At the same time, they could see the problems that posed, because since public opinion was so powerful, unpopular views, like their own views about slavery and race, had a very hard time obtaining a hearing. And this was also something that when Wendell Phillips read Alexis de Tocqueville, really resonated with him in Tocqueville's analysis, the idea that that even though America was supposedly the freest society, it seemed like everyone sort of held the same opinions and everyone thought more or less the same way. And this was really troubling for Tocqueville because a lot of European critics of American democracy to that point had said, if you allow the people to rule and if you remove the checks of property and aristocracy, you'll have essentially anarchy. You know, their view of democracy was shaped by their experiences with the French Revolution. And they thought, you know, you're going to have bloodshed and violence and anarchy if you allow democracy to rule. And what Tocqueville discovered when he came to the U.S. was precisely the opposite, that rather than unleashing anarchy and this sort of freewheeling diversity of opinions, that public opinion had molded Americans more or less into the same sort of uniform view about things, and even pointed to things like racism and slavery as examples of this. So that really, I argue, resonated with the abolitionists. It sort of clarified for them why, even though they believed in democracy and had relied on public opinion and trusted in public opinion as the vehicle for their hopes, why they had been so battered by mobs and by persecution and by resistance, even from northern audiences in Massachusetts, for example. So Tocqueville, I think, sort of crystallized for Phillips particularly how public opinion and rule by public opinion could actually lead to moral stagnation and conformity and a dislike for controversial views or dissent. And that's one reason why I think the Garrisonians were so insistent on agitation, even of unpopular subjects like feminism or non-resistance. Mm-hmm. You know, they believed not just that they should agitate in order to affect particular ends like the abolition of slavery, but that agitation was important as an end in and of itself, that simply to circulate unpopular views and to make sure they obtained a hearing was one guard against the kinds of dangers of democracy that Tocqueville was pointing out.
Mm-hmm. One of those dangers, as you point out in your book, was nationalism. A minute ago, you quoted the language from the masthead of the Liberator, "Our country is the world, our countrymen are all mankind." Yet, I mean, that's a statement of cosmopolitanism, obviously, but abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison and even Frederick Douglass mm-hmm. were and or could be very ardent nationalists. You know, many of our listeners will be familiar with Abraham Lincoln's lament that one of the reasons he hated slavery was that it deprived the United States of the moral influence that it would otherwise have mm-hmm. in the world, that people were able to dismiss American criticism as, you know, base hypocrisy.
Right.
So there is this paradox that it's at the one time, abolitionists are critics of American nationalism and ardent cosmopolitans, but they were not immune from American nationalism. How do you explain that seeming paradox?
Well, I think that that's a great point, and actually it touches on one of the big differences between the book and the dissertation that I wrote at Hopkins. You know, I mentioned earlier that when I was writing the dissertation, what I was really struck by was the cosmopolitanism of the abolitionists and by these, you know, seemingly very, very radical, very still current ideas that they were circulating about identifying with the world and instead of just with their country. And so the dissertation really focused on that cosmopolitan idealism. I remember one of the readers on my dissertation committee pointed out, one of the outside readers said, you know, well, if you've proved anything, it's that abolitionists said our country is the world a lot. Because, you know, every time that abolitionists said our country is Ouch. The world, you know, I had included that in the manuscript. So I was very taken by that side of them. But, you know, I was also – I couldn't – the more that I thought about my sources, and particularly as I did research that sort of extended chronologically – my treatment of the Garrisonians, both backwards in time and also forwards in time through the Civil War, I couldn't really get around you know, what you're pointing out, that abolitionists were very committed nationalists of a kind, that they really believed in the American experiment. You know, Garrison, who I talk about in the first chapter, had really grown up, you know, a convinced, ardent nationalist who believed that the United States was a model for other Republican movements and revolutions elsewhere in the world. And so that sense of those strong statements of American mission to the world, or American exceptionalism that most people associate with Lincoln, you know, we are the last best hope on earth, we stand for government by the people, for the people, of the people. One of the things that the book shows is that Garrisonians also partook of that. So I had to sort of figure out how to reconcile the internationalism and the cosmopolitanism of statements like our country is the world with their nationalism. I think I was helped by the fact that a lot of historians of nationalism in recent years have pictured nationalism itself as an international movement. You know, what we see as a philosophical mm-hmm. paradox between nationalism and internationalism might obscure the historical coexistence and really co-development of nationalism and internationalism, partly out of necessity. A lot of European nationalists, people like Mazzini, the Italian nationalist who I talk about in the book, in order to be successful, they had to build international ties with other nationalists in Europe. And so they would at one and the same time say, you know, we have to save Italy and everything depends on Italy's national independence. And at the same time, they would swear allegiance to the world and really emphasize their cosmopolitan networks and bona fides. So the literature on European nationalism as an international movement and is really intertwined with internationalism was helpful in formulating the arguments of the book. And also recognizing that as cosmopolitans, the Garrisonians became involved in this transatlantic conversation about democracy and about the promise and the problems of democracy, helped clarify, you know, what kind of a nation they wanted the United States to be and why they were so interested in seeing the American experiment succeed. It was partly because they wanted to see democracy succeed on the world stage.
Mm-hmm. You know, the vitality of American democracy in the 1830s, 40s, 50s can actually obscure the fact that this era, you know, internationally, mm-hmm. was actually one of a resurgent, you know, reactionary movements mm-hmm. and aristocracy.
Right.
And the abolitionists were keenly aware that aristocracy may seem like something quaint,
right.
Like, you know, we pay attention for some reason to the birth of this baby over in England and people care about that for some reason, even though I think it's un-American to do so. But Garrisonians were very aware that aristocracy was alive and well, and that the triumph of democracy was not a foregone conclusion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How was that spirit of aristocracy alive and well, and how did Garrisonians fight it both at home and abroad?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think we look back and think that, you know, after the American and French Revolution, that democracy was sort of destined to continue on in its career. But if you look at the early 19th century and the setbacks to, say, the revolutions of 1848, for Democrats at the time, I don't think, you know, they were as comfortable as we might make them out to be. I mean, it really seemed possible, especially after the failures of the 1848 revolutions, that a lot of the gains made by Democrats in Europe would be rolled back. You know, the Parliamentary Reform Act of 1832 in England, which was hailed at the time as sort of this major expansion of the electorate in England. Even after that, there were still only about 20%, I think, of the adults, male population of England could vote because of the still high property qualifications in England. And so radical Democrats, people like the Chartists who argued for universal suffrage, were, you know, persecuted and ultimately also turned back in the reactionary post-1848 movements. Mm-hmm. So I think abolitionists were, and American Democrats generally, were aware of this, and the difference between abolitionists maybe and the run-of-the-mill Jacksonian Democrat who would point these things out about England was that abolitionists also believed aristocracy was alive and well in the United States. You know, they looked at the slaveholding class as an aristocracy, as a slave power, and they, even though the Garrisonians have typically been seen as separate from political abolitionists who are upset about the slave power, I argue in the book that that Garrisonians too were very concerned by the aristocratic features of slavery in the United States. And so I think there was a real sense, you know, that Lincoln expressed, of course, most eloquently when he talked about how at the Gettysburg Address, we don't want government of the people to perish from the earth, that that government of the people perishing from the earth was actually a live option in the mid-19th century in the minds of the people living through it. And I think that abolitionists also had that strong sense of urgency. And I think we've missed that to some extent by, again, emphasizing the Garrisonians' religious radicalism, their perfectionism, their non-resistance, to the exclusion of their interest in political democracy and in making democracy work so that its safety and its promise could be demonstrated to the world.
You know, Garrisonians were very leery of politics, as you said. They, you know, they wanted influence, but they were also afraid that influence might change them as much as they changed the United States. What were some of the major events internationally that sort of taught them about the potential of influence and what it could do for them? And what lessons did they learn from things like Irish repeal and the Anti-Corn Law League?
Right. So as you pointed out, the abolitionists, the Garrisonians did decide after 1840 to refrain from voting. And most of them refrained even from endorsing political candidates explicitly or joining in things like the Liberty Party or the Free Soil Party. But I argue in the book that they still very much wanted political influence. They wanted to be able to change what was happening in Congress or in the polls. So they needed some proof that agitating public opinion, which they also thought was important in its own right, as a way to ward off the perils of democratic conformity and stagnation, could that agitation be influential? Could it actually be effective? And what they saw when they looked abroad at contemporary movements like Irish Repeal or the Anti-Corn Law League was proof in their minds that extra parliamentary movements, so popular movements that took place out of doors or outside of legislatures, could still affect legislative change, could still shape policy. So the Irish Repeal movement, for example, was led by Daniel O'Connell, who had earlier led a movement for Catholic emancipation in England to allow Catholics the right to serve in Parliament. And he had been sort of held up not only by not only within Ireland, but also even within Europe. O'Connell was sort of seen as proof of the power of a popular movement to actually change aristocrats who were reluctant to give in. And O'Connell tried the same thing with the Irish Repeal movement, which sought to repeal the union between England and Ireland, less successfully, but still using popular meetings, large monster meetings, as they were called, of Irish agitators who wanted to repeal the union, that unsettled aristocrats in England. And so when Garrisonians saw the success of the Irish Repeal movement, and they corresponded very closely with Irish repealers and with Irish abolitionists who knew O'Connell personally, those networks were sort of leading them to read the Irish Repeal movement in a certain way as proof that extra-parliamentary agitation could be effective. And they were even more impressed by the Anti-Corn Law League, which succeeded in 1846 in securing the repeal of the corn laws. And after you know a fairly brief but very active career of the Anti-Corn Law League, which was modeled in a lot of ways on the British anti-slavery movement's reliance on publications and propaganda and speeches and meetings and all the apparatus of a popular reform movement. So when Garrisonians saw the success of the Anti-Corn Law League, they believed that agitating in the United States could be effective, despite what political abolitionists were telling them about their sort of failure to engage in the political process.
Mm-hmm. You know, this book details some of the really close relationships, the personal relationships between abolitionists on both sides of the Atlantic. In some ways, American abolitionists, especially African-American abolitionists, sometimes felt more at home in England than they felt in the States. Mm-hmm. But the Civil War put a lot of pressure on the transatlantic anti-slavery networks. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about the Civil War, created those tensions?
Well, one of the things I argue in the book is that, over the decades when abolitionists had corresponded with British abolitionists, they had really relied on British abolitionists to help them point out all of the problems with American democracy, to, as I said earlier, help shame Americans into doing something about slavery. And mm-hmm. Every American abolitionists went to Britain, they would lambast the United States and talk about all of its contradictions and hypocrisies. And their British friends, when they heard that, were very convinced, were very persuaded that the United States was a pretty bad place. Conversely, when American abolitionists corresponded with Anti-Corn Law Leaguers or Irish Repealers or Chartists who pointed out all the problems with aristocracy in Britain, that sort of reinforced for American abolitionists that Britain wasn't exactly the empire of freedom that it claimed to be either. And so before the Civil War, both those arguments made sense for strategic reasons, but I think what the Civil War exposed was how much nationalism really both British abolitionists and American abolitionists had retained all along, so that when the war breaks out and rather than rushing to support the Union cause, there's a lot of dispute within Britain about the real purposes of the war, and there's a lot of disagreement about whether England should intervene. And even some of the abolitionists' anti-slavery friends are critical of the Lincoln administration over things like its tariff policies, instead of giving a sort of full-throated endorsement of Lincoln and the Union cause. A lot of American abolitionists feel wounded or sort of betrayed. They see the Civil War as the moment that is finally going to make success possible. Is going to make emancipation inevitable. And instead of cheering alongside them, British abolitionists are critical and also, are sort of questioning Garrisonians about how, even though they've been non-resistance for two decades, now they're suddenly, jumping on the bandwagon and beating the drum for war.
Yeah, that was a pretty good question, though.
It was a good question. I mean, I think it again kind of exposes, though, that we misread the Garrisonians if we see them only as committed non-resistance. That there were commitments that went deeper for Garrisonians than non-resistance. But that was a good question, at the time. It put a lot of strain on these transatlantic networks that were only partially repaired after the war.
Well, how quickly do you think that American abolitionists, among the non-resistors, of course, it needs to be said that not every or even most abolitionists in the United States could be lumped under Garrisonians. Right. There were many, many, many different splinter groups.
Not all Garrisonians were non-resistants, is it?
Yeah. So it's one of the problems with the movement. It's so left-wing movements in general, you could argue, mm-hmm. seem to splinter in a lot of different ways. But how quickly and how easily do you think they did reconcile to the fact that slavery looked like it might be finally on the way to extinction, yet the means through that happy event was a massive, unbelievably violent war?
Well, they were conscious of that that tension, but they had, even in the late 1850s, and other historians have written about this. People like Stanley Harold have talked about how, you know, as the 1850s wore on, abolitionists really of all sorts had come to an accommodation with the idea that violence might be needed to deal with slavery in the United States. And of course, they moved towards that conclusion at different paces. You know, someone like John Brown got there much quicker than someone like William Lloyd Garrison. But yeah. But even Garrison, you know, in, for example, writing about Brown or writing about slave rebellions, even as early as the 1830s, you know, when the Nat Turner Revolt occurred, Garrison very controversially and very radically, you know, for the time, said, of course, we don't condone violence and, you know, we would never incite this kind of bloodshed. But if any group was ever justified, you know, in taking up arms to free itself and secure its rights, then the slaves would be that group, you know. And they really, from the beginning of their movement, had always spoken about violence in that way, that they themselves distanced themselves from violence. But, you know, if violence ever were justified, it was more justified in the pursuit of liberty than in the maintenance of slavery. And so I think some people will still see the Garrisonians' capitulation to violence and to the war as a sort of sudden turn of events. I see it as the culmination of a much longer and ongoing process of accommodation to violence that had been going on since the 1830s. And really, we have to also think about the Garrisonians in the context of their whole lives, that these were also people, post-revolutionary Americans, who believed very strongly that the American Revolution, despite its violence, had secured good things. You know, Garrison, as a young apprentice printer, was a huge fan of Lafayette and George Washington and romantic freedom fighters like Bolivar and Lord Byron in Greece, you know, followed very closely the revolutions in the 1820s and the 1830s in Europe. So they were people who were, despite their conversion to non-resistance, were still, you know, still believed that revolutions of the kind that took place in the Civil War could sometimes produce good.
So abolitionists were, especially those in England and America, were split over Civil War issues. But as you say, they were really divided by the questions of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I personally think that compared to the Civil War, Reconstruction, it's so much more divisive, so much more problematic. Mm-hmm. Just trying to, you know, forge a peace that would be both just mm-hmm. and agreeable. And not only did it split English from American abolitionists, but you argue that it split American abolitionists, especially, you know, Phillips and Garrison, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. really divided over a number of issues. Whether it was, you know, what their view of Lincoln should be, mm-hmm. you know, his halting steps towards emancipation, and especially the question of black suffrage. Mm-hmm. Why was Reconstruction such a divisive event for anti-slavery activists?
Well, I think that the main point of division between Garrison and Phillips really was their disagreement about whether to support Abraham Lincoln's reelection in 1864. And a lot of previous historians of the split between Phillips and Garrison have seen that disagreement is really rooted in a difference about black suffrage, that Phillips opposed Lincoln's reelection because he wasn't convinced that Lincoln was going to pursue radical Reconstruction policies that would dispossess slaveholders of their lands and ensure that full democracy sort of was put into place in the Reconstruction South. Whereas Garrison, some previous interpreters have argued, sort of hedged on that question a little bit, or was less committed to the idea of black suffrage. I argue against that to some extent, that I don't think Garrison was really uncommitted to black suffrage, but that he and Phillips disagreed about the timing of calls for various reconstruction policies, and specifically were divided about whether it was wise to oppose Abraham Lincoln's reelection in the middle of the war, when Garrison believed that many anti-war Democrats were really threatening to divide the North. And, you know, if the Republicans weren't reelected, then Garrison believed that would be disastrous for the cause of abolitionists, and that, you know, potentially there were people who might even attempt to roll back emancipation in the courts, or to suggest that emancipation wasn't final. This was all, you know, before the 13th Amendment had been secured. So in that sort of last chapter, without without maybe giving away, you know, any spoilers, I see their division about Lincoln as rooted partly in their earlier views about public opinion that we talked about earlier. You know, abolitionists were very convinced in the power of public opinion, but despite the amount of faith that they put in public opinion, they actually didn't have a very unified view of how to measure public opinion and how to gauge where public opinion was heading. And so part of their disagreements during Reconstruction really stemmed from different interpretations of the state of public opinion at the time. Phillips believed that the North was ready to move forward on more radical Reconstruction policies. Garrison was less convinced that public opinion had matured that far, and a lot of their disagreements came down to that difference of opinion.
Right. You know, I think that's the first time I've ever heard a historian use the word spoiler to describe a history book. This is not an episode of Sherlock.
Yeah, they all die in the end.
Oh, damn, you gave it away. I know this may seem a perverse question, given that you've just spent about 12 or 13 years on this book, and you just published it, and you should be celebrating. But what is next for you?
Well, I've sort of started on a project less about anti-slavery and more about slavery. I'm interested in slavery and emancipation in Texas and Louisiana right now. Partly, I'm interested in the ways that various forms of slavery survived the end of the Civil War, and this was a problem that was of great concern to people like Wendell Phillips. And also reflects one of my interests in thinking about how historians can help clarify our understanding of the persistence of forms of slavery beyond legal abolition. I'm actually now a board member for a group called Historians Against Slavery, which you can find at historiansagainstslavery.org, which was founded by Jim Stewart, a great abolitionist historian, a few years ago, to try to get historians to think about how our scholarship and our expertise on slavery and anti-slavery can inform policy and activism in the present about different forms of slavery. I'm also increasingly interested in digital history. One of the things that I'm doing with this new book is actually I've started an online research notebook for the project that people can sort of follow along with and see the notes that I'm taking as I work on the new project to experiment with new platforms for open notebook humanities and history research. So as you started off by saying the abolitionists were sort of the good guys of history, I guess I've worked on the good guys, and now I'm I'm looking a little bit at some of the bad guys.
Okay. Well, you actually anticipated my next question, which I wanted to invite you to talk about Historians Against Slavery, which you've already done. And I do encourage our listeners to go to the website, and all praise to Jim Stewart for beginning that organization.
Yes.
You obviously write a lot about anti-slavery and slavery, and you certainly teach about it. Mm-hmm. How surprised are you? Of course, I'm sure you bring up the issue of contemporary slavery to your students. Are they surprised, as mine are, I think, here, to learn that slavery is still a problem, that it didn't end in 1888 in Brazil or in 65 in the United States, that this is a problem that Mars, our contemporary world?
Yeah, I think that students are. I've actually just met with some undergraduates here at Rice who are forming a group through the Free Project, which is also somewhat affiliated with Historians Against Slavery. It's basically a website that helps student groups start, organizations that would help them tackle this issue, learn more about this issue, raise awareness about this issue. And that's typically the way that students are drawn to it, is the idea that, slavery didn't end in 1865. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the public interest in it also comes from that. You know, they see a movie like Lincoln, and, it depicts this great event. It's sort of the end of slavery. How could it still have survived? But I think that one of the things that historians of slavery know is that slavery and slaveholders were always very resourceful about adjusting to
yes, <they were. laughs>
to different circumstances, and that in a sense the problem of slavery doesn't go away because it shifts shape rather than ever sort of being totally ended. I think actually sometimes perhaps the way that activists about slavery in the present talk about slavery, where the main goal is to end slavery, or we could be the generation that ends slavery, you know, may actually miss that side of slavery, that this is not something that, what we've learned, I guess, from the past is that even legal abolition, you know, even if you could reach a point where it seemed that slavery was ended, that doesn't mean that, you know, you can sort of rest or let up on being vigilant about the ways that it resurrects in different forms.
That's right.
Wendell Phillips, actually, this is one of Jim Stewart's favorite quotes from Phillips, which I was really delighted that one of the students here at Rice actually started this meeting the other day with this quote from Wendell Phillips. you know, he talked about during Reconstruction that we have abolished the slave, but the master remains. And I think that's a useful way of thinking about it, that rather than talking about the end of slavery, to see the way that enslavement and processes of enslavement and people who would be enslavers continue to exist in our world.
Yep. You've already suggested, apropos your discussion of your research, that you're very sophisticated guy technologically. You're into the digital humanities. You're also very active on Twitter. So if our listeners wanted to follow you, where would they get you? What's
Absolutely.
Your hashtag?
They can find me at WCaleb.
Excellent. Caleb McDaniel, we've taken an hour of your life, and we're going to give it back to you now. So thanks so much for joining us today.
It's an honor. Thanks, Dan.
Excellent. Thanks very much. This has been Dan Kilbride from New Books in American Studies. We've been talking with W. Caleb McDaniel about his book, The Problem of Democracy in the Age of Slavery. You'll find a little button on this book at the site of the interview, and I encourage everybody to click on it and throw some royalties Caleb's way. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.